Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. I know we love our natural resources. Sometimes we love them to death. Management of our forests has been an issue. There's this roadless rule that President Clinton, 2001, initiated, and it really cut off road construction. It hampered timber harvest. It hampered development in a lot of ways. Environmentalists liked it for a lot of reasons. They want all those things cut off. But you know, there's economies to consider here as well. And this is you and me, right? When we talk about economy, we're talking about you and me. And our families, right? And going forward. So we're going to talk about this proposal to rescind the roadless rule. And there's another issue we'll talk about here, corner crossings. Ellie Brighton is with us with the Montana Stock Growers Association. Got a lot to cover here today on Voices. So this goes back to 2001 when this roadless rule was initiated. It was challenged. I don't think it went to the Supreme Court. I think there was a district court decision during the Obama administration that upheld it. What is this roadless rule? Like I said, it prohibited the road construction, timber harvesting, large-scale development on a lot of national forest land, 58 million acres. It included 6.5 million acres in Montana. You go back to 2001, I think you'll see that, of course, environmentalists have loved it because we haven't been able to get into our forests and do anything with them. And it's not just our forests. It's all public land. So the BLM is involved in this. Now, as we talk with the Montana Stock Growers Association about this, they've come out, very much in favor of rescinding this roadless rule. And there's other things on the plate, too. A big case out of Wyoming regarding public lands and corner crossing. This is where you have checkered areas of private land and public land, and hunters on public lands are hoping to cross right on the corner of these lots, plots, so to speak. And that's exactly what it is, corner crossing, a Wyoming case we'll talk about too. And with who? It's Ellie Brighton of the Montana Stock Growers Association with the Stock Growers, again, it's Government Affairs Specialist. I have you kind of down as Policy Director too, Ellie, but Government Affairs Specialist. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you guys?
Hanging in there, right? We did have a Montana weekend to hang out in. Now we'll work to get back to that.
Right.
How big is this? How big an issue is this roadless rule? Not just with the stock growers. I know the environmental industry, the timber industry. There's a lot here going on. How big a case is this?
Yeah. So this is fairly significant, I think. Specifically with, of course, the world I'm in, which is natural resource management, ranchers, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, even environmental groups are really engaged in this issue. And I'm looking right now and I can't see that it's been published yet. I'm guessing they haven't tracked it down yet, how many formal public comments there were on the roadless rule. But I would guess there were, tens of thousands probably. People are pretty passionate about this issue. And it's interesting because, like you said, it's been around since 2001. It's not really a new conversation, but it sure fires people up.
What has happened since 2001? Because I know why they initiated it. They felt that there was some environmental degradation going on, and I'm not sure that this roadless rule has made an impact in that regard, but it has certainly made an impact in other areas of our economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest thing that comes to top of mind for all of us is, especially being here in the West, is the inability to access areas we used to be able to access. And primarily I look at that as timber management. We see catastrophic wildfires every year, and thank goodness this last year has been a little better for us here in Montana. But across the West, we see these catastrophic wildfires that are destroying our grazing lands, destroying our forests. destroying wildlife habitat. And, you know, we can't access that land that really needs to be accessed for fuels reduction, timber management in general, right? I mean, it's a natural resource that belongs to our the people, and we can't access that either to manage it. So, I mean, to me, that's the biggest change we're seeing is the inability to, manage the timberland, which has cascading consequences.
Well, how strong is this rule then? Why can't we access? Is there no provision for those kinds of just regular common managements? Or has this rule been changed over the years? Is it not being used? A lot of questions, right? Is it not being used as it's intended? Why can't we access this land under this rule?
Well, you know, I'm learning a lot about it too, as this has been reopened. But no, I mean, I think there's limited exceptions. They closed roads off, and there were very, very limited examples of when you could access those roads. And the hard part about that, too, is that many of those roads still exist. So it doesn't just prohibit the building of new roads, which I think would be a different conversation, but it prohibits, you know, accessing roads that have existed. And so I think that makes it challenging when we are used to managing in a certain way and accessing certain areas that need to be accessed for whatever reason. Maybe they're more susceptible to fire. And now those roads that were previously open are no longer open. And so it completely changed the way that forest management was happening across the West. And like I said, I don't think there's many exceptions to it. And so kind of in that same vein, we've lost forest allotments as well because they're too difficult to access, or you can't. And so that's, you know, as representative of grazers, you know, we're losing a serious fuels reduction tool as well there. So I think there's consequences beyond maybe what they originally intended. And the 24 years that it's been since it's been implemented has shown us those consequences.
Yeah. Government affairs specialist with Montana Stock Growers Association, it's Ellie Brighton with us here, as we're talking about this 2001 roadless rule and then the proposal to rescind it. We'll get to corner crossings too. That's another important issue here. 6.5 million acres in Montana of this federal land, this rule that applies here. As much as you know, how strong is this in the courts? I know there was a 10th Circuit Court of Opinion on it that upheld it, at least the president's authority, to enact a roadless rule. It wasn't enacted by Congress, as I understand it. You know, what are, if you're going to roll this back, how do you do it?
That is the $1 million question. I don't, and you know, I'm not an attorney. I don't know the strength of it in the courts. I will say, you know, it's an agency rulemaking process, USDA, US Forest Service. So, I mean, they have the ability to roll it back within their legal frameworks, you know. But as far as whether or not it would be challenged, I mean, I'm sure it would be, but the strength of that, I don't know. It's an interesting issue.
When it bumps into stock growers or others, and we can talk with the forest industry about this as well, because you know they've been battling, though I think this and other probably misdirected information as well for a lot of years. But how does this impact? Is there an example of how this might impact stock growers specifically? Like you said, it was grazing. What is the breadth and width of that impact?
Yeah. So I think our hope is that we're going to see vacant allotments opened, designated grazing allotments within forest systems that have essentially kind of gone away, whether it was because the agency was no longer able to, renew permits because of the rule or because permittees were like, we need to be able to access them and we can't. Our hope is that becomes a top priority, because not only is it a cost savings, fuels reduction, resource management tool from the agency side, but also it gives more producers, you know, access to more land, which is, as always, something we work hard on, access to land. So that's our hope, but, you know, there's 44.7 million acres that are eligible to be kind of reopened, and that's a huge task for our agencies to work through. So I think there is still a question of whether or not there would be a full environmental impact statement prepared, which would probably lay out some priorities. That may or may not happen. I think another way to go about it would be to just kind of have the agency analyze which areas specifically would be best to open, looking at, you know, response to fire. Like I said, grazing allotments, of course, is a priority for us, habitat management, things like that. And so I think the best way, I guess, is as someone who's not going to be implementing it, would be to kind of prioritize the issues that are important to local economies and local communities, and start there. But it's going to take years. It's a huge process.
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, but it's got to start somewhere here as well. Ellie Brighton, again, Government Affairs Specialist, Montana Stock Growers Association, mtbeef.org for information there. How frustrated are, well, stock growers, but you know, people in other industry who are opposing this, how frustrated are they that this is all played across like a court, a net in the middle? It depends on what election you win or lose, and you throw volleys back and forth. Everything's off limits. Nothing's off limits on one side or the other. And this happens every 4 to 8 years. How frustrating is that? Or are there moves to try and codify this? I know Montana has a good neighbor authority, which has been effective. Any hint that something could come from Congress?
That's a tough question too, right? Yeah. I think we would hope so. We would hope so, but Congress sometimes is efficient, sometimes is not, and I would say recently has been less efficient. So
you're being kind. I know. Yeah, good for you.
Frustrating. Yeah. Frustrating. And so I think it's, I guess I am not super optimistic in that area, but maybe I'm too cynical. I don't know. But I think this administration is pretty, they're focused on making changes quickly, right? Like they've only been in for 8 months, right? Mm-hmm. 8-9 months. And they're already rolling back rules and things that have been super detrimental for the natural resource community. So I'm really grateful to see that. I think they understand they need to get going early to get through all the bureaucratic hoops. And I'm hopeful that the way that they implement it will be a lot more change in administration proof, for lack of a better term. So I am hopeful that they are a little bit more focused on that just after their, you know, the previous, the first Trump administration, knowing that things got changed with the Biden administration, maybe being a little more aware of the fact that things could volley. So I guess right now that's just hopeful. But like I said, them getting started so early on in their administration to me is a really good sign that we're going to be able to get some of this a little bit more cemented.
Yeah, I appreciate that, too. And I understand the dynamics behind that. Private rights versus public access. We speak on that frequently. This will be the corner crossing case we'll get to here in a little bit with the Montana Stock Growers Association. Ellie Brighton is with us. mtbeef.org, and she's the government affairs specialist. Welcome back from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana. You want to text a message? You got a question? We're talking about this roadless rule, 2001 roadless rule, 58 million acres of U.S. national forest land where it prohibited road construction, timber harvest, large-scale developments with very little exceptions. That included 6.5 million acres in Montana. It's been a volleyball back and forth between administrations. Do we use our resources? Do we stay out of the forest, so to speak? And there's a lot of folks that have said fire suppression has become more difficult. Not only that, we're not using our resources to the benefit of everybody. in our country. Ellie Brighton again with us here. Ellie, thanks for coming alongside. I appreciate that. It really is a key issue to talk about here. One of the things that we have seen over the years as, you know, they have passed some reform, the Equal Access to Justice Act, which essentially allowed folks to sue the government. You didn't have to be rich to take on the government, which, you know, in mm-hmm. itself as a principle was good, but it's been manipulated. The Endangered Species Act, same thing. In and of itself, a principle was good. It was not implemented correctly because they did not have any economic considerations, and there should be, because that is us. That's you and I and everybody listening to us here today. So as we talk about these little, well, it's not little, the Roldis Rule Rescission, we're really looking at some of these bigger, well, I don't know what you call them, laws that ground all of this. Can we move that major discussion? Can we move that discussion from, oh gosh, get out of the forest, that's the only way to save it, more toward the middle where let's have an economic consideration, let's manage these things with common sense, and not be so agendized.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, like you said, we as a natural resource industry have been asking for that for decades. And I do think this Congress, even though I just got done saying I'm not sure what they're going to get done,
right.
I do think this Congress has an appetite for that.
Wow.
And regardless of if the bills make it all the way through, I think it's encouraging, at least for me, to know that our Congress is aware of it and they want to address it. And it puts some pressure on the administration. It puts pressure on other politicians as well, just to be like, hey, this is a big deal. We need to talk about it. So that's been really good to see. I will say specifically on Endangered Species Act, there is a bill in the House, which is ESA Amendments Act of 2025, a very simple name. And there are many co-sponsors. I can't even count them all right here,
nice.
Like 30 or something.
Wow.
So I think that has some legs, at least to make its way through Congress as much as we can. But just looking at things like, you know, a 5-year review required, that we can't let these species stay listed for 20 years without reviewing them every 5 years. You know, things like that. So I think there's some good tools in there that really will help the Endangered Species Act become a little more effective.
A 5-year review, and I know, again, you know, knowing every detail of this bill, so to speak, is that's not what we're asking. But did they take small bites? Because there's some major reform I think that's needed. But yeah. If they approached it with a little bit, you know, a 3 to 5 yard play, as our governor would say. Did they do that in this ESA amendments bill?
I think so. I think they addressed just some different areas of ESA. I know I mentioned the 5-year review, but there's some like financial disclosures that are required, things like that. And I think those kind of, you know, start to get their fingers in a few different pots, if you will, within ESA, and kind of push it in the right direction, even though I think we could all make the argument that there, like you said, there needs to be significant changes. There are quite a few listed in this bill, but they're all kind of spread out through a couple different areas within ESA. And I think that will just kind of help, I don't know, clean up the process, I hope, and require a little more oversight. I would say that's something I see is we don't really have a lot of oversight. Fish and Wildlife says, this is what's happening, and there's really no way to argue it. So I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful.
Yeah. And I've been hopeful as well that some of our environmental organizations splinter a little bit, because there are a number of them that really do manipulate the Equal Access to Justice Act for a lot of purposes. Mostly it's for marketing. I mean, it's become, I know there's a figure behind it, but it has become a multi-billion-dollar industry. In that, they lose track of some of their goals, in my mind, their goals change. There are others, and I know the Montana Stock Growers have been working. I can't remember. We did a show with Rayleigh Honeycutt, your executive president, a little while ago. And the question I'm trying to get to, sorry, is Is there more of an appetite for some of these environmental groups to recognize that, you know, their all-out agenda is harmful, you know, in other large ways?
I don't know. I don't know that that's there. I think that, I think within the agency and within the administration, yes. I think within the groups themselves, I don't see that. They've been successful in essentially pushing their own agenda through the courts, primarily using EJA and things like that. And so I don't think that they're quite at the point where they recognize that there are other factors to be considered that are they're equally as important. So again, maybe I'm just cynical, but I don't see a lot of hope there. But I do, like you've mentioned, the EJA issue and reform. I do think there is an appetite for EJA reform within the administration and potentially within Congress. There's been conversations about it, but I haven't seen anything firm yet. So we will kind of see where that goes. But I think that could also, just like changing ESA and reforming it, could have a huge impact there.
We're going to look at this corner crossing case out of Wyoming. It's impactful as well here in just a little bit. Ellie Brighton is with us with the Montana Stock Growers Association, the government affairs specialist. Let's wrap up with the Royalist Rule. I guess the question is, I mean, where does this end? I know we've talked about we don't necessarily have a timeline. There was a comment period. It was short. It's over. Mm-hmm. I read some headlines where, 99%, but again, I just can't trust a lot of press anymore, saying that, there was a lot of opposition to rescinding this rule. Mm-hmm. That doesn't surprise me because that's a process that's manipulated now, too. Where does this end?
Yeah, well, I think, the timeline I'm hearing just through scuttlebutt, I guess, is that it will be spring of next year, which to me is a pretty decent timeline coming from our federal government. So I'm not too upset about that. I hope we'll see the rescission. I would guess we're going to see at least a partial rescission. They look at the public comments that are submitted, but they don't necessarily accept all of them. They need to be substantive and they need to include research and things like that. So even if 99% were opposed, if they were just one-liners saying we oppose this, that doesn't carry as much weight as a substantive comment with legal precedent or research. So I'm hopeful that the educated, public comments will outweigh in support of the rescission. But regardless, I think there'll be a partial rescission. I think there'll be some changes either way because they've opened this can of worms. And I think we all know that there would be massive positive impacts for our industry. So I am looking forward to that and seeing what they do there. But I think, like I've mentioned, I think the administration is really, really gung-ho to repeal harmful agency rulemaking. So I think we're in a good spot here.
Yeah, there's just been such a strong far-left grip on our public lands and the public environmental process as well. I'd like to see that pendulum switch. So I'm encouraged as well. We're talking about the Roadless Rule rescission proposal from the current administration. And now we're going to move on here to this corner crossing case. As I hit earlier, it is about private rights versus public access. And to explain it, I'm going to have somebody who knows it a lot better than I do. Ellie Brighton with us again with the Montana Stock Growers Association, government affairs specialist as well. And Ellie, I mean, I can look at this. And again, thanks for being here and sharing this conversation. It's important for us to talk about these things. I can understand it in this essence. It's the private rights versus public access. But practically speaking, there's a lot to this case. Can you tell us from the start and where we're at and where it's going?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is a complicated issue. So essentially, this is another step in the litigation process. So the original litigation kind of centered around four hunters who had accessed checkerboarded public land, which we all know there's a significant amount of that across the West, via a ladder over the corner of private property in Wyoming. So The landowner who became the plaintiff in this litigation was concerned about that. He wanted to ensure that we could uphold the longstanding principle that considered corner crossing to be trespass. And so in March of this year, the 10th Circuit Court upheld the right to corner cross, and so they sided with the defendants, not the plaintiffs, to access federal lands as long as the private landowner's land was not physically touched. So that latter situation would be crossing over into the airspace over that private land. So the plaintiff then filed a petition for the case to be elevated to the United States Supreme Court. And that's where, you know, stock growers came in. That's where Wyoming stock growers and us Montana stock growers filed an amicus brief, which for those unfamiliar is like us considered a friend of the court brief. So it's just some additional support on behalf of the plaintiff asking the Supreme Court to take this case up. So that was really, really the priority was to emphasize the importance of this from a private land perspective and ask the Supreme Court to address this.
How does this impact or influence public land access?
I think it's a, you know, it's another one of those subjects that's a big conversation, and there's a lot of passion and emotion behind it. And I think there's also a lot of previous legal precedent behind it. But, you know, it could limit some public access to public lands that are, you know, within private lands. But really, that's no different than the way that things have been. So really, we're just looking at upholding what's already been determined based on precedent. So it's not going to be, to my knowledge, that the intent is not to close off any lands that are currently accessible by, you know, county roads and things like that. There's no changes there. But I think it's an issue that people get really passionate about. So
yeah, and how much of an issue is it? I mean, we do have a checkerboard. I guess you would just call it, geography out there. Mm-hmm. Why does it rise to such a high level?
Yeah, well, like you said, there's just a significant amount of property that would fall under this. The checkerboarded issue. And then I think too, you know, we as a private property rights organization, it's important to us that that landowners are able to do what they want with their land and protect their lands the way that they need to. And so I know that there are private landowners out there that don't have a problem with corner crossing, and they should have the right to allow people to corner cross if that's what they want. But people that have a concern with it should also have the right to protect their land. So that's kind of the, I guess, two sides of the same coin we're seeing across the West. This is a debate too that's been increasing in recent years, and you know, there's been attempted legislation here in Montana and I believe in Wyoming as well, but I don't quote me on that. And so it's just really kind of been elevating significantly in the past few years. And so I think for us, we believe that a Supreme Court decision is really going to be the best way to settle the debate once and for all.
Yeah, I think so too. And what's the timeline on that?
It's a court case. Who knows? Probably a long time. I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing the Supreme Court take on decisions fairly quickly, quicker than we have in the past. But, you know, we don't have an answer yet whether or not they will agree to take it up. So that will be the next step. And then, I guess then whenever they get to it, that's the following step. So I'm guessing a few years probably, but who knows?
How has it tracked so far? I guess I'm not knowing a whole lot about it, but how you guys have wrote an amicus brief. So you've been following at least it through the court cases. What's been said? I mean, how's it tracking so far?
I think that we're in a fairly similar space, of course, as Wyoming stock growers and the plaintiffs as well, in just that we, you know, really our emphasis in the amicus brief was we want the Supreme Court to address this more than anything else. The emphasis is that we need, like I said, we need a Supreme Court decision to decide it one way or the other. There's too many questions, I think, when it comes from legislation or even you know, a circuit court decision, right? Like, that can be appealed, which is what we're doing. So that's really been the emphasis. And I think that, you know, that's where we're at right now. So I think if the Supreme Court decides to take the case up, it may be a different conversation of what priorities are, or what the plaintiff's asking for, that sort of thing. But the stage that we're in, where we're currently at, is just, this is an important issue. Here's a whole bunch of reasons why it's an important issue, and we need the Supreme Court to address it.
Yes, anything that does tackle private rights and public access. I mean, we do want to have a real definitive answer to some of those questions. Ellie Brighton, again, absolutely, is with us here as we talked about the Roadless Rule repeal and also now this corner crossing case with the Montana Stock Growers Association. There's something else on your plate, though, you noted, and it involves public lands and the BLM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So the rescission of the BLM public lands rule is out and about as well right now. So on September 11th, that proposed rescission was released, and they opened a 60-day comment period through November 10th, I believe. And they're looking at rescinding that rule that got a lot of press, I would say, over the last few years. It was originally released, the draft rule was in April of 2023. Almost exactly a year later, the final rule was released in April of 2024. And that rule through the BLM had a lot of issues. From the jump, you know, it was a top-down rule. So I know in talking with our local BLM staff, they were not consulted with the ideas behind it, and neither were any kind of stakeholders. And then there were, again, this is another one of those issues where there were significant public comment, and the agency still went ahead with the proposed rule as they had presented it. And so for those of you that don't remember, the rule was essentially elevating conservation to be considered an equal use under the multiple use mandate for BLM. So that was really our biggest concern, but another piece of that too was it increased the agency's ability to designate and kind of change in areas of ACECs, areas of critical environmental concern. Mm-hmm. and so it really changed kind of the oversight structure and changed the way that we saw that permits could be implemented, and it was a major shift, I would say. And so there was significant industry concern there.
Yes. And you caught me now. I'm reminded of that. And for me, it was a very dangerous signal, mm-hmm. because it completely went against the Taylor Grazing Act, and it did that without any kind of congressional oversight. As I recall. And it was that administration trying to grab, whether they had authority or not, you know, and that's what we worry about is these executive orders. You know, Congress itself is probably weakened. The courts, I think, are, you know, courts and the executive branch, it's not balanced like I think people feel it is. So thanks for reminding me about that. Can they simply rescind that? Because it was an agency policy, if I recall. Yeah.
Yeah, it was thoroughly like an agency policy rulemaking process. So, yes, they can rescind it. I mean, there's the process that we're going through right now, of course, with public comment and things like that. And I'm sure there's legal reviews and all of that as well internally. But I'm hopeful. And, you know, something that I found interesting in the Federal Register notice there was that, you know, this administration, this BLM said, hey, there were lots of comments submitted, not all of them considered, which, like I explained a few minutes ago, is fairly common. But a lot of the issues brought up in those comments were not addressed, and that's an issue. So I think that is super encouraging, too, to know that, like, this agency does this administration does emphasize public comment, public engagement. They want to know what the people think. So I'm hopeful here.
Yeah, and I mean, that one just, I think, I'm hopeful too, because that one just, that's, I'm pointing fingers right at the former BLM director for this, and that real cozy connection that she had with a lot of these Montana folks. I mean, this is, this that one too was all about the American Prairie Reserve, you know, trying again to usurp congressional authority in enacting some of their waivers and plans. That was part of that as well. So I'm glad you're fighting out there. I'm glad you're out there, you know, putting these things. Anything else on our plate, on your plate that we should be knowing about?
Oh, there's always things on the plate. Yeah. No, I mean, I think, you know, we're moving in a pretty positive direction. I will say I enjoy writing my comments to the federal government a lot more this year than I did at this time last year. So that's been good. Another big topic, I guess, is the USDA reorganization, just the potential kind of moves there. But, you know, it's so early in that process. I think there's either, it's either 4 or 5 page memo on what that's going to look like. And, you know, it's a huge agency. There's a lot of moving pieces there, and it's going to take more than a 5-page memo to kind of designate out how that's going to go. So we're still in the early phases there, and what that's going to look like. But that's another thing to just kind of keep your eyes on moving forward.
Good. Thank you for that. You know, we are part of the Northern Ag Network, and Colter Brown, Andy Schwab, and Colton Young, and others do such a great job over there, covering a lot of these agricultural issues. But yeah, we haven't talked a ton here on Voices. Well, we do frequently. So just give us an update. I know the price of cattle is up, but inputs are up as well. It's record prices, though, for the industry. How are people doing?
Good. I mean, I feel like people have a good attitude. It's always something I kind of sense, you know, and I'm seeing good attitude here. I think, you know, there were some parts of the state that were pretty dry this year, and that was hard. And there were some parts of the state that had more water than ever. So, you know, it's hard to say kind of what's going on across the board. I feel like it's really regional this year, specifically with weather. And but people seem to be good, in good spirits, which I always appreciate. And, you know, it's kind of to the same tune. We're seeing increased disaster assistance for cattle producers from the federal government as well. So when we're seeing some of those areas that have severe drought, I think we're going to see some better assistance there as well. So I think things are going positive right now, and I'm going to hold on to that as long as we can.
Nice. Well, 140 years of history behind you guys for advocating for Montana stock growers. And so very much appreciate you coming on. And these are important issues, important times. Ellie, thank you for your information today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Ellie Brighton again with the Montana Stock Growers Association. It's mtbeef.org. Yes, beef, it's what's for dinner. Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.